We'll hear appeal number 06-1214, McKenzie Engineering versus Department of the Army. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
We're ready to hear from you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, sir. That's
very well.
There's no T sound. It's MERS.
MERS. No, I was mispronouncing it. I apologize.
Mark, MERS, please proceed.
Judge Lurie, Judge Michelle, Judge Prost. May it please the Court, my name is Charles F. MERS, attorney in this case representing the appellant, McKenzie Engineering Incorporated. The matter today has to do with our claims for various matters involving contract in Mississippi. I'm sure
you should be assured that we're thoroughly familiar with the facts of the case.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, that's what I just said. McKenzie asserts a claim for acceleration of the work based on the fact of extended delays in issuing a change order granting an extension of the contract performance period as a result of a flood incident.
I thought acceleration had to be ordered by the government.
But it doesn't have to be ordered, Your Honor. The actions of the government will result in an implied order or an implied requirement that forces the contractor to accelerate, and in that case, then there's the implied order to accelerate. In this case, for example, the contractor had repeatedly requested.
Even if the contractor drew an implication that the government wanted him to accelerate, I didn't see any evidence that he did accelerate.
Well, Your Honor, our position is that any time that you perform a contract beyond the time limits that are or outside of the framework of time that the contract allows, then you're essentially working at an accelerated rate over what you would ordinarily. In this case,
I've never heard of that. This is acceleration per se because an extension that's been requested hasn't yet been granted. That equals acceleration per se?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, I think it's all fact-specific. In this case here, and this, in all honesty, is the first case I ran into where it involved an exclusionary period in which the contractor was not required to perform any work. In fact, was excused from performing work. The fact that he had hanging over him the potential for liquidated damages.
Don't walk away from the question. I'm trying to understand what I thought you said. I thought you said that any time any contractor, not fact specific here, any contractor hasn't received an extension, he's entitled to assume that he's been constructively ordered to accelerate. I thought that's what you said. Did I misunderstand?
Well, essentially, that's what I am saying.
Well, that wouldn't be fact-specific. That would be a broad general rule that you're suggesting. Well, what authority can you cite for such a per se rule?
Well, I don't have authority to tip my tongue. What I do have, though, Your Honor, is that there are extensive case law which have held that the government, by failing to issue a timely change order, effectively holds the club up.
All right, well, let's talk about timeliness. There was an oral request in the summer, I think in June, for an extension, and there was some kind of oral assurance that an extension would ultimately be allowed. Then in late October, your client wrote a letter to the Corps formally requesting an extension and presumably requesting that it be put in writing. And then there was the delay between that October 27th letter and the January 18th grant of the extension. But most of that time was downtime anyway. Winter, bad weather time that no work was expected to be done. So how can your client say that he was, you know, hiring extra workers or more equipment or working two shifts or working double time or overtime when it was almost this entire period of delay between the late October letter and the mid-January granted the extension was downtime. He was doing no work, not double time work, no work.
Well, the facts are that, first of all, he made an original request to Ryan Newman. He's testified, and the evidence is unrebutted, that he made repeated requests throughout the summer of 1997 for a written documentation of his extension. He does say that there was discussions, there was some agreement that he was going to get one, get an extension, but it never was forthcoming. Consequently, he repeatedly reminded the government, I need this writing. I need this in writing. I need a contract extension.
What is the evidence that at any point in the summer or fall, forget about the winter period I was directing your attention, what is the evidence at any point that he speeded up the pace of the work and thereby incurred greater costs per day than he would have otherwise?
The speeding up of the work, Your Honor, was performing the work during the exclusionary period, during a time when he wasn't required to. He could have done that work in the spring when the exclusionary period ended and work would have moved at a much more efficient pace. But he lost efficiency by having to work through the winter because of the threat of the liquidated damages. So his speeding up was by accomplishing the work.
I thought you were saying, well, the time of the speed up was in the summer or the fall. Now you're back to saying it was in the winter.
I misunderstood it. I'm sorry if I conveyed that. That's not what I intended. The time of speed up occurred from the beginning of the exclusionary period until the project was completed in February 1998. That's our position, that he was not required to work during that period. In fact, he was specifically excused from working during that.
From October to February?
No, actually, November 1 to February.
November 1, 97 to someday in February 98.
Yes, sir.
You're saying he was actually working, and ordinarily, that would be downtime.
That's correct.
So you're saying that's what constitutes the acceleration?
Yes, sir. He was essentially speeding up during a time when he was working at all. If he did anything, he was essentially speeding up the completion of the contract during a time when he was not expected.
But in January, he got the formal letter granting him the extension. So how can the rest of January and any days in February be under a cloud of a threatened liquidated damages or any other sort of sanction? At that point, he knew he had gotten every day of delay that he wanted. Every day of the May-June storms, he was being given an extra day for completion. So in that portion of the winter, it seems to me he has no acceleration argument at all. He's expressly not worried that he's going to be penalized because he's been told he won't be penalized because he's been given all the days of delay back.
I tend to agree.
So then the period would be November 1 to January 18 would be the period in which you say the acceleration occurred because normally there'd be no work, but in fact there would be work?
That would be a fair assessment, Your Honor, because I mean he could have stopped at that point, come back in May and finished up the last little bit, but at that point he was a week or two away from being completed. And most of that was done on a change.
Why shouldn't we take that to be his choice based on his convenience rather than something compelled by the government?
You know, the case before the board and the Court of Federal Claims in this court, and I can't remember the downside specifically.
On the facts of this case, why wouldn't a prudent marine contractor realize that he could finish in May if that was preferable because the contract would allow that, but that if he wanted to finish the short amount of remaining work in a few weeks of the winter, he could do that and he made his choice. If the government didn't require him to make the choice, why isn't it a business decision, not government compulsion with equitable adjustment remedies as a matter of entitlement?
I think the key term in your question is prudent, Your Honor. The government itself testified that it would not have been prudent for him to rely on the government's assurance that he was going to get a change order. There's innumerable cases where government agencies have either made factual or legal mistakes interpreting the contract imposing with the big dam song.
The contract had an act of God clause in it. The flooding was an act of God.
Yes, sir.
How could the government possibly have denied the extension of the contract for 5 weeks of late spring flooding when it's expressly provided for in the contract?
But, Your Honor, there are numerous cases where that has occurred, where the government has erroneously assessed liquidated damages. It puts the client in a position where the government's holding his money. He's got to spend money to file a claim to pursue that, get his money back, which the government has erroneously withheld. He gets interest, but at the rate of the treasury bills, it's not, you know, it's a de minimis amount of interest relative to his risk.
Before your time moves on too fast, what about the cause and satisfaction?
Your Honor, the testimony was from the government that modification, Mod 4, was issued specifically under the defaults clause. And the testimony from the government was that the government never discusses monetary damages or monetary claims on changes arising out of acts of God, flooding, etc. It was never contemplated when they sat down and determined the amount of extension of the contract. For the flood event.
Are you allowed to walk away from the clear language of a contract by making an argument that subjectively you didn't think that those issues were a part of the settlement?
Your Honor, the clear language of the contract doesn't support the government's interpretation. It simply says that because of this act of God, because of these delays in the contract, we're going to extend the contract and you're giving up any claims arising out of the act of God. Our claim is based on the act of man. The failure to issue the
court satisfaction says it's further understood that the adjustment provided herein, is that not the adjustment, the extension of time because of these delays in the so-called act of God?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, all right, then adjustment provided for herein. Compensation in full. For all costs and offer correctly attributable to the change order, for all delays and performance of the change.
But as you just said, the adjustment provided herein is simply the extension of the contract because of the flood event. It does not address and does not, it clearly doesn't, can't encompass the government's acts in delaying.
Sure it does. It says all costs.
Compensation.
But it's all costs for what, Your Honor? It's
all
costs arising out of the flood delay because it only addresses the flood delay.
All delays.
Essentially say that. It could say, you know, interpret that and say all other claims that we haven't specifically reserved. And I think that's an overbroad reading of the interpretation of that.
Well, it's a broad reading because it's a broad line.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. But I think that you have to.
If you had intended a narrow reading, you could try to negotiate a narrow reading.
But I think the narrowness is defined by the scope of the change order itself.
Were you involved in the drafting of Mod 4?
No, sir, I wasn't.
Were you in the case at that
point? I was being consulted at that point, and I interpreted, as I'm arguing to you now, that this modification only addressed the flood event and the consequences of that flood event, not the consequences of the government's inaction in issuing a change order for that flood event.
I don't see the word flood event. Flood event.
Well, the evidence, the testimony was and recited to it in the record in our briefs, that the modification was directed only at that event.
Is that the wrong evidence?
It shows the intent of the parties in adopting the language, but of course it is for a language. But we submit that it was not the intent of the parties to make this as a waiver, and the government's own witnesses indicated that. Right. This argument is after the fact.
Do you want to save the remainder of your rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Major?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Am I doing any better on pronunciation?
You're fine, Your Honor.
Very well. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
May it please the Court. There is no case law supporting the proposition that the lack of order or lack of request to accelerate results in acceleration, even under the case law signed by the plaintiff.
Well, are you saying there's no such a thing as constructive or implied acceleration?
No, there is constructive implied acceleration.
That's what he says he's relying on.
relying upon
constructive order of acceleration.
That's correct, Your Honor, but there are certain factors you need to meet in order to have a constructive acceleration case. He cites the Norair case, which compresses the factors somewhat. The Frazier case, also decided by this court and cited in our brief, provides a more full explanation of the factors and talks about the need for a request from the contracting officer, a denial or a failure to act, and then separately...
Well, he says here that he has an extended failure to act. Repeated requests for an extension to compensate for 5 weeks of floods, orally and repeatedly, finally in writing, and only 8 or 9 months after the floods does the government grant the extension. So he's saying that's exactly the prong of the test that he comes under. Where is that wrong?
Well, I was focusing more upon the insistence of completion, but with regards to the failure to act, in May, the contractor merely provided a speculative estimate of how much time he felt he might need in addition for the flood event. Then the contractor did absolutely nothing until early October. The government reminded him that he needed to provide his actual delay, the amount of time that he needed in addition because of the flood. Again, he did nothing until the contract completion date when he sent a letter to the government providing the amount of time additional that he needed. And that letter was immediately followed up by a letter requesting damages for the delay. The government's failure to act...
Well, are you saying then that somehow he waived his delay claim by not providing the data that the government had sought?
Well, he had failed to provide anything adequate to have an acceleration claim in this case. We're focusing upon acceleration in this case. But
I'm asking about his request for an extension of the completion time. And I understood you to be saying, well, he didn't tell us what we needed to be told in order to evaluate his request for an extension, because we didn't know whether he was asking for 1 day, or 5 weeks, or 3 weeks, or what. And until we knew how many days he was asking for and why, we couldn't rule on his request for an extension. I thought that was what you were saying.
That's correct. Until October 27th, he had not provided the government with what was needed to grant him additional time under the contract.
Where had the government specified what it needed from him?
There was an oral request, and the government had told him, basically, we need the actual dates of the flood. The only request he submitted was he estimated that he felt it would be an additional 2 weeks. At the end of the day, the government ended up having to give him 5 weeks because of the flood delay.
Well, it sounds like the flood delay wasn't disputed then. The government gave him more than he even asked for initially. It sounds like everybody agreed that Rock Island was underwater for 5 weeks in May and June of 1996, I guess.
Well, throughout the process, everyone agreed that there was a need for an extension for a flood delay. That's where there's...
Look, if the government had the information about how bad the flooding was, why didn't it just give him all the days immediately?
Well, because simply providing a speculative estimate to the government because it ends
it's
up...
It's not a speculative estimate if everybody knows he didn't even get on the site and start working until June 23rd, and the reason was for the prior 5 weeks there was serious flooding there for all to see, government and contractor.
Well, but you don't know how much time he's going to be using for other purposes under the contract. He wasn't simply working at the site on the contract. There were a number of other things he had to do in terms of design and the like. You don't know how much of that he's going to claim is due to the flood and how much of that is due to other factors. That's why he needs to provide the government with an actual estimate, or more than an actual estimate, an actual calculation of how he was delayed by the flood.
So your view is that all of these verbal requests and all of these verbal assurances don't matter because there is a requirement that he specifically lay out all the facts before he's entitled to anything?
That's correct on one level, Your Honor, although I will say the record doesn't specify when these verbal requests are occurring. It notes that they're verbal requests, but it doesn't say whether those requests are coming in October, in June, in November, in December.
isn't this a little unfair? You want us to rely on the oral statements of the government's agents, but you're telling us we can't rely on the oral statements of the contractor. It seems like it should either be we don't rely on anybody's oral statements, or if we're going to accept oral statements as being probative from the one side, we should also equally accept them from the other side.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not saying that the oral statements are probative with regards to whether the government denied or failed to act with regards to his claim, but they are at least probative with regards to whether the government insisted on completion of a timely date, one of the factors set forth in Frazier. And the government's point is that it is impossible to say that there is a insistence upon completion in a timely fashion when completion of the contract in a timely fashion, when the government has repeatedly told the contracting officer that it's going to grant an extension, does not specifically...
An extension of what? One day? A one-day extension wouldn't do me any good if I'm the contractor. If I lost 5 weeks, presumably I need a 5-week extension. So until the government tells me whether it's one day or 5 weeks, I don't know anything useful.
The government had agreed that it would extend for the delay due to the flood. And again, it needed that data from the contracting officer ultimately to determine. The contractor could have noted he was delayed for 6 weeks. He could have noted he was only delayed for 2 weeks.
So you're saying these verbal assurances were sufficient. Do we know who gave them? The government is saying that the people who gave those verbal assurances had the authority to do so?
I believe it was the administrative contracting officer in this case, so he would have had authority to give those verbal assurances. But again, verbal assurances are again only a factor. The government isn't relying solely upon verbal assurances in this case. In a different case, it might be possible that there would be verbal assurances, and yet, also, if the government was, say, sending a letter saying, we need to make sure you complete, something like the situation in Norair, in which the government said, you know, I request that you speed up or accelerate your performance in order to complete this contract in time.
He's asking for $1 million in increase in the contract price as an equitable adjustment. $700,000 contract, now it's suddenly $1.7 million.
That's the nature of his overall claims, Your Honor.
Yeah. Now, as I understood it, the board viewed that he wasn't able to allocate any portion of his approximately $1 million in overcharges to any particular cause.
There were some, a number of damages issues. The board, with regards to the acceleration claim, didn't specifically rule on a number of the factors and didn't contemplate damages. And as we know in our brief, the board did not rule and did not determine whether or not he was actually accelerated or not. Our argument, and we raised that argument to know.
What I'm trying to ask you is your basic position that he had a failure of proof. He put in a bill for an extra $1 million, but he couldn't show which of those dollars connected to which cause. And therefore, he hasn't proved a single dollar out of the $1 million plus.
I believe that was one of the issues noted at the board.
Why isn't that dispositive? If his proof fails to link particular portions of his $1 million claim to particular causes, then he hasn't, quote, proven his case. He should lose. All other factors now irrelevant.
I would agree that that would support that. That would be an alternative basis for supporting the board's determination.
That's true. We don't have to worry about what does or doesn't constitute constructive acceleration.
That's correct, Your Honor. And just to clarify a couple of other points with regards to the accord and satisfaction issue. The plaintiff said that the government's testimony, which we submit as parole evidence, trying to alter the plain language of the contract clause or the modification,
you say you submit as parole evidence.
Well, we would
say, was it admitted by the board or not admitted by the board?
It was, I believe it was taken by the board. The testimony was provided by the witnesses with regards to meaning of the clause. Although, actually, none of the witnesses really testified to the meaning of the clause. The point I'm trying to make is the witnesses basically noted that, number one, that...
Are you objecting to anybody, including us, relying on what those witnesses said on the grounds that it's parole evidence that was improperly admitted? Is that your point? It's tainted evidence, no court should be using it? Is that what you're saying?
The court didn't rely upon it in issuing its determination, although, yes, that testimony cannot be relied to alter the plain language of the contract document. And more specifically...
So you're not saying we can't look at it.
You're
saying we can't do anything with it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And while that actual testimony went to separate issues, specifically, the witnesses noted and the documents note that the government doesn't calculate potential damages when issuing a modification that includes only time. But that does not mean, as the plaintiff asserted, that they did not consider the possibility of damages. The November 7th letter was already before the contracting officer at that time. And Mr. McKenzie had already accrued the majority of, or all of his damages that would have accrued from the extension. Finally, with regards to interference, just briefly, I think we covered that issue adequately in our briefs.
I didn't hear Mr. Bruce having argued that at all.
Yes, and it was...
Doesn't that make it out of order for you to be trying to make an argument on a point that he, as the appellant, hasn't raised orally?
Well, it was raised in the brief.
Well, and you've answered it in the brief, but you shouldn't get two chances to argue it if he only had one.
My point was, Your Honor, I was going to raise it in the event the court had any questions in that regard.
Anything further?
That's all from the government, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
For those reasons, the reasons set forth in our brief, we respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the question that you raised, that is, as to the quantum issue that was presented in the claim. The claim had any number of bases resulted in that calculation. The hearing
billions, the sum total of discrete subtotals.
It was that, but it was also based on a kind of a more of a modified lump sum claim.
Then I think the answer is no. It's not the sum of discrete.
Well, it was
subsidiary amounts.
Well, I guess it is the sum of all those discrete.
It's an estimate of what would be the sum if you could calculate the discrete amount.
That's right, Your Honor. We weren't prepared to calculate it because the issue was strictly on the question of entitlement, not quantum. There's repeated references in the evidence in a case where the government had tried to raise issues on quantum, and the board sustained objections because that was, none of the quantum was before the board. So there was no effort to present any specific damages related to any delays. But Mr. McKenzie did testify, and the government agreed, that it's a lot less efficient to work during the winter months than it is during regular job performance period. So there is implicit in that a basis for damage calculations to be resolved in the next phase.
Am I right that the last few weeks of work could have been done in May and June of 98, but in fact were done in January and February of 98.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was...
So the government would have been satisfied if he finished by sometime in June, but he elected to finish by sometime in February.
That's correct, Your Honor. I have to concede that because of the inefficiencies. He's had his entire marine plant there, barges, equipment, everything else. He would have had to dismantle that and move it for those last two or three weeks of the job.
I think I would have done the same thing he did.
So
I already have all my workers and all the rented equipment, or even if I own it, right there, and I only have two or three or four weeks of work to do, of course I'm going to keep working and finish it up unless the winter conditions absolutely prevent it.
Without waiting...
That sounds like a business choice.
That is, Your Honor, and without waiting any rights to pursue that, those last... few weeks of plant damages for those last few weeks. I would concede for you, though, that the once he had received his assurance that the contract was going to be extended, he had no other motivation to continue. With regard to the time, scheduling the time of why the government did not schedule a meeting in July, for example, that it scheduled in January to the determination of Mod 4, I remind the court that the record shows that McKinsey began work on June 23. They know when the flood started. There was no question at all, no question raised as to what McKinsey was doing before that time. McKinsey testified he was ready to begin on May 15, except for the flood event. So, with that, Your Honor, we'd ask that the board overrule the court overrule the board's decision and amend the case for further proceedings and the next phase of questions.
Thank you. We appreciate the argument and briefs of both attorneys. We'll take the appeal under advice.
Thank you.